Hi, welcome to the ESI What's Next podcast. I'm your host, Alex Feldman, and I'm taking you on a journey to learn about the exciting student entrepreneurs coming out of the ESI program. In the first part of our mini-series, Upcycling for Your Pets, we're sitting down with Maya Krestina, Communications at Zero Waste Latvia, to learn about how to make products that have minimal environmental impact by minimizing their waste products. Living on a planet with finite resources, we can't afford to waste any of them. We need to find a way to ensure that the future generations can enjoy the Earth in the same way we do. Hi, Maya. Thank you so much for joining us today. Before we get started, can you tell people a little bit about yourself and your journey?
Yes. Hello, everyone. I'm Maya Krestina from Zero Waste Latvia. I'm communications lead and lecturer at Zero Waste Latvia. And we are an NGO working towards zero waste or less waste future for Latvia, but also for Europe. We're working with civil society, with society at large, and also with the governments and decision makers to make this happen.
Perfect. Let's say backing up a little bit and focusing a little bit on you, I'm kind of curious on two fronts. Let's say one, why did you decide to get involved with trying to solve the waste problem? And two, why did you decide, let's say, to work on the communications aspect? Let's say there's many roles that you can play in trying to solve the waste problem. Why was communications important for you?
Well, waste, it's always super tricky to respond to this one, because waste is not something that people are usually thinking, you know, of as their dream job. But I don't know, I just naturally ended up in it. I think I grew up with this notion of, being environmentally aware, eco-conscious. It's something I think was transmitted by my grandparents. And yes, eventually, as I advanced in my life, I realized how many things are actually being like wasted. And I saw waste as one of the big problems in our world, in our societies. So that's why I tried to, that's why I joined Zero Waste Movement. And communications is something that I do. That's my professional role. And I've been working with startups in my career, both in communications and marketing. And communications are super important in all of this, because unless we spread awareness and create pressure for the governments, nothing will ever change. There's no point discussing this in our little corner. We need to go out, spread the message, and talk to everyone about this, raise awareness.
What do you think right now is kind of the biggest challenges in communicating these ideas and kind of spreading the message, as you put it?
Yeah, well, it's the phenomena of don't look up. It has never been this clear that we're kind of, this is it. We've reached really that it's we can barely, I mean, we can only hope that we can change things, but at this speed as we're going, it's probably even too late. So it's crazy that we see, you know, scientists are saying we see climate change really now impacting our lives wherever we would be, and nothing is really changing. Everyone just it's like we're driving into the wall and no one is actually putting on brakes. So we've seen in the past weeks and in the past months some really intense communications actions being carried out in the museums, also in London, these guys who are spilling the orange color. And some say, yeah, we understand what you're saying, but this is not the way to do it. But really, I think at this point, we don't know what to do anymore, actually, to alert decision makers that this is it. We need to do something or it will be too late. So this is a massive challenge. This is the major challenge, how to actually make decision makers realize that we're really arriving at the final point where it will be too late to change anything.
Let's say, what do you think it is that is preventing people from getting on board or let's say getting this information or like, it seems like, let's say, if everyone would get on board, people, it would be really easy to make the necessary changes. But since we're showing that that's not happening, what's preventing that from happening?
Well, I think in to some extent it's the financial interest, and we've seen also this weird concept that some multimillionaires are building for them, like these, you know, underground solution in case the world goes disappears or there's a major climate catastrophe. Well, the thing is, I mean, they know, they realize, but they're kind of thinking, you know, that they will escape, you know, by going to a different planet or living under the earth or something. Well, it would be just enough to stop doing what we're doing. And I think, unfortunately, many people really don't believe in science or don't want to believe in science and want to believe in the financial interest. What would be needed is really to flip it over and tax policies, products that are really harmful for the environment. And I mean, I think it really, some people don't want to do it, absolutely don't want to do that and share their part.
Let's say there's a couple of interesting things of what you said. I'm curious to touch on this one, and I don't know, we'll see where it goes. It seems to me that one of the potential issues is, let's say, the people of, let's say, higher socioeconomic class tend to be the ones who are consuming more.
Exactly.
And so to a certain extent, you talked about, let's say, the people who are in position to make these policy decisions don't have incentives to actually change them because they're the ones who are benefiting from the way things are today. So it seems to be a much, let's say, more difficult or potentially uphill battle than it might seem on the surface, because you're kind of fighting against the interests of the people who are in decision-making powers to
exactly.
go against it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And let's say if you look maybe at you know, the examples in decision-making and NGO world, I mean, it's quite perverse. You know, we as an NGOs, of course, we're raising awareness and we're trying to you know, bring information and discuss what needs to be done with them. But there's no funding for us. We're doing it almost for free. And then sometimes we get funding, and if we are too loud, then our funding is cut again. It's a vicious circle.
I want to go in a slightly different direction, and I'm curious, as a communications person, what you think about it. It seems like, let's say, the people who are putting kind of a downward pushback against these kinds of changes are doing kind of what I would call almost certainly one playbook, which is essentially something that the tobacco companies used to do kind of back in the day, of their kind of putting out a lot of other information into the world to make, let's say, to make it seem like that this decision is actually more complex than it is, if that
Absolutely.
Makes sense, and kind
yeah.
of putting counter arguments that feed their own interests. This is kind of, yeah, an old playbook. I mean, the cigarette companies used to do this. We're talking probably, what, 40, 50 years ago. I think car companies did this for a moment. I think sugar, like a lot of them took kind of the same playbook. I think some of the, you know, which things cause cancer, you see it kind of over and over again. And I think it, to me, it seems like that playbook is maybe more effective nowadays.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead.
No, exactly. I mean, the same in the climate change. What they're saying is, well, you know, climate change is a natural phenomenon. You know, if you look in the past, there have been ups and downs and cycles. And so it's just okay. It's normal. It's natural. It'll be, you know, things will be back to normal again. That's a common narrative that we hear. Well, the scientists on the other side are saying something completely, completely different. But what is different with the tobacco textbook and tobacco narrative is that tobacco affected relatively small, well, a portion of people, a portion of consumers, a portion of patients. Climate change is something that is starting to affect almost everyone on this planet. So this is and this tobacco industry argumentation and and textbook is amplified these days by social media. Of course, social media, unfortunately, has been a major change maker in this game, because the amplification of fake news, fake narratives, is extremely strong. The divide, a lack of dialogue, inability to listen to each other's arguments. That the basis has been definitely this tobacco textbook narrative, but then amplification of from social media by social media has been tremendous.
Well, I think also, let's say, if we look back at when, let's say, tobacco was doing their first playbook, a lot of the challenge that, let's say, an individual consumer had was there was, let's say, limited access to information. And so basically, I think a lot of their playbook is, oh, we don't know enough yet. And I think the difference, and kind of you touched on this, the difference is what we see now is with social media, it's actually not that we have too little information. It's actually we have too much information, and it becomes, let's say, for the average person, it becomes more and more difficult for them to figure out, you know, what information to trust, what's accurate, et cetera. And I think kind of leading to what you touched on is I think that leads people to almost a path of least resistance and going, which piece of information is kind of most in line with either my beliefs or political orientation or something that they find comfort in because it kind of matches who they feel they are, which kind of leads to this more divide is sort of, well, there's so much out there, it's hard to parse. So I kind of just go to the information I'm comfortable with, and kind of that tends to lead towards echo chambers and the like.
Yeah. And one thing that we see is that some organizations are actually starting to create libraries again. I think one great source of information, for example, is MacArthur Foundation, which provide clear data, or other organizations that are creating libraries of data where people can find trustful sources of information, because indeed the amount of information is tremendous, and sometimes it's really one is saying one thing and the other one is saying complete opposite. But also speaking of data, what is very, very important that in some jurisdictions, in some countries, it is super difficult to find data because data is power. If you have now data, you can't prove anything. There's no growth, no degrowth, no volumes. There's what are we talking about? So access to data is access and information is crucial. And that we really see that also here in Latvia, for example, that access to data or clear data is extremely difficult, because that's how you can actually build credible narratives based in credible data. So your data and information is an increasing challenge.
A different side of this that I'm kind of curious of your thoughts on the data side, and I think we touched on this a little bit in our pre-conversation. It seems like, I'm going to throw out this quote a little bit because I think it's somewhat relevant. Attributed to Churchill, I don't know whether or not that's true, but he said something to the effect of there's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics. And it seems like that there are some people that say that are, for incentive reasons, using the data for their own purposes before, lots of people would call this, you know, forms of greenwashing or whatever, you know, again, there becomes a, how do you end up trusting this? It becomes a little bit for me of if there is a incentive involved, one way or the other, to a certain extent, some of the data can be tainted or can be tweaked, manufactured to give the message that fits into the incentives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for example, when it comes to waste, usually we when we gather at European level with Zero Waste Europe, we have these yearly or biannual gatherings, and then we always have one workshop about data, because data in waste is incredible. This is you know, you can compare data in volume, you can compare in cubic meters, you can have this, you can have that, and what is that you're comparing? And often if you don't know how to read the data or how to present the data, then you can be easily fooled around. We've seen this also this year, for example, in a debate about wood and forests and foraging, how easily it is to say that there's absolutely no problem with the forest management here in Latvia and misrepresentation of data. And it's very easy to convince society about certain things if you present data in one or another way. So it brings us back to the, you know, data literacy. You know, this is something that is never taught in schools, or you know, analytical skills is not something that is part of high school curriculum. And people are easily lost in this. And also, even those who are actually trying to access data and be convinced by credible sources of information, it's very easy to be fooled around.
On that kind of front, I'm really curious, let's say yourself or kind of within Zero Waste Latvia, what do you guys see as, let's say as a consumer, what are the key metrics that they should be looking for? What types of data do you see as credible? I'm curious of which ones do you suggest? And I guess that's, you know, I would imagine that these things are always, let's say, changing with the science and so on. So let's say, as of right now, with the caveat that this is probably going to adapt over time, as of today, we're, you know, it's 2022, November, this is what we think is kind of the best that we can work with, given what we know at the moment.
Yeah, this is a really good question. Well, one interesting piece of information is how much of waste each habitant is producing per year, per habitant. That's something usually people don't know. And what is really interesting is to compare it look at the data for the past 20 years. And when you see that, it's like, it's a steep hill. It's uphill like this. And where you easily say, all right, this is insane. We're producing a tremendous amount of waste. And it looks like we're not going to stop. We're going to drown in our own waste. And then second thing is, all right, where this waste comes from? What's in it? Where do you produce waste? And funny enough, well, or not, here in Latvia, for example, it's food waste. It's 40% is organic waste. And part of that is food waste. Food waste is 100 kilos per year per habitant, which makes between 335-500 euros per year per habitant, which is like, wow, you're actually throwing money in your, you know, in a bin. So, yeah, these are two, for example, two pieces of data that are interesting for people. Always say wow when they see that, they had not realized that. And then I think one very interesting thing is actually, where does our waste go? And that's something, it's not even a number or a piece of data. It's actually interesting to go and see that place, but also realize that that's a tremendous massive mountain, which is about to be too high. So the question is, where are we putting our next trash mountain? Do you want to have it next door from you? And that's also right. People usually say, no, absolutely not. But then what should we do about it?
I think that last point is something I want to build off of. I think one of the really interesting things about the space, right, is that often, let's say, the consequences of our wasteful actions are not actually in our immediate backyards. And someone else somewhere far away that we don't, let's say, interact with, we don't see, is the one who actually takes the consequences, right? So yeah, the person who's actually doing it isn't actually responsible for the end result. And as well as, though, I think it also makes it somewhat difficult to figure out, right? If it's not so close to you, it's somewhat difficult. Maybe I'm wrong, but my understanding is it's relatively difficult to follow the actual trail, because it ends up being so far from wherever your starting point is.
Yeah, well, that's why what I say lately is that we should probably whenever we suggest that the next landfill is in someone's neighborhood, then there's an immediate discussion. Why is that you oppose having a landfill in your area? I mean, don't you think it's great to have a landfill? And it immediately starts a conversation. The same is when actually sometimes something goes wrong with the waste company and they don't pick up the garbage bins, and they start to pile up and it looks like a massive, almost like a little waste mountain in your own backyard. Then you kind of start to realize, okay, this is what we're producing. This is what it's impressive. And yes, it's a problem that people actually do not understand where their waste goes. Recently, there is a campaign that has been started, which is asking vote for your landfill, vote your landfill, choose your landfill. And the advertising company who made this campaign, they kind of thought that people understand what it means, that people will have to choose where to put the landfill. Do you want a landfill in your area? Choose where you want to have your landfill. And of course, people will choose the neighbor's area. But what the agency didn't realize is that people have no idea what this means to have a landfill in your area. So I think this campaign will not go very well. People don't realize what it is. Because if they would, then there would be a change in thinking. But also another thing is that currently what I've seen is that in conventional media, we really do not get any news pieces about this waste emergency. We are actually currently, Riga, Latvia, is in a waste emergency. We haven't heard this in the evening news, right? We have one campaign that will be starting was this rationale of voting bogus voting for the landfill in your area, but we haven't really heard that there's a problem. No one has told us there's a problem. So there's this magic process that you know you voila, you take your waste, you throw it in a bin, someone takes it away. It's not too expensive, and that's it. It's okay. There's no problem. No one has ever told that there's a problem, unless there's a small NGO called Zero Waste Latvia or some other who are eventually saying something on the social media or on the media. We haven't heard that there's a problem.
I mean, I think that's one thing that, especially let's say with the modern media landscape, is not really designed for problems that are chronic. There's essentially no way to keep people's attention for problems that, let's say, essentially don't have a fix that's an immediate fix. If it's something that's kind of a long-term incremental, or I mean, maybe you don't believe this is an incremental thing, but sort of something that will take years to actually solve. It seems like there's a challenge on communicating this in a way that you actually keep people's attention long enough to actually make a difference.
Yeah, I'm not sure there has ever been in attention at all, because the whole attention and campaigns have been actually about recycling mostly, you know, telling people how to recycle, or more, even more specifically, how to sort the waste. Because of course, people are not recycling, people are sorting waste, and then some of the waste gets recycled and some not. But it has never been really a focus on something else, saying like, hey, you should reduce waste, you should not buy this or take this because it's doing that and that. There has never really been the focus on that. And it's not surprising because of the structures, how it is. I mean, I think there are many, waste is a massive industry. It brings a lot of money to some people. We can see it also, you know, in Italy, mafia is always around the waste. Waste is a big thing. And then I think it's a kind of disbalanced debate. You know, we had their NGOs, and then there's everyone else, you know, and, you know, you can't really rely just on NGOs telling the story because we're just not powerful enough.
Awesome. We've kind of gone through quite a bit of this. I'm going to change gears slightly, and I'm curious to on your take of it that's a little bit more connected to kind of what ESI is doing. Let's say, considering your background and trying to create kind of more, let's say, circular products or products that are less wasteful, let's say, For someone new that's trying to develop something, let's say from scratch, let's say on one side, what challenges do they have to make something that's actually kind of sustainable and minimizes the waste they do? And what kind of recommendations or steps or considerations should they have when they are developing this product?
Yeah, I think well, one problem is the local legislation that sometimes can change quite a lot. So when you're creating a product, and this is also something that companies are telling us, is that legislation is either blurry, it changes too often. There's no stability. I think that's something that also foreign investors have said. Or there's absence of legislation, which creates a void and uncertainty. So when you're a company, you want to come in and market, or you're someone who wants to develop a product, the legislative bit is really a pain. But then where you can look for solutions is look at the European frame and European ambitions and European strategy, because it's pretty clear that it probably Europe is kind of setting higher targets, and there'll be even higher targets that will change as well. But they will be probably overarching and more clear than local legislation in some countries. So looking at the European strategy, either for circular economy or Green Deal, is, I would say, a safe approach where to look for the guidelines and how you can be in advance with what you create.
And let's say a slightly similar question. Let's say based on your understanding of the space, where do you see, let's say, potential opportunities for, let's say, a startup and an entrepreneur to come in and like bring a solution to some various waste problems out there? What are you kind of, I don't know, put some insight to something like that?
Oh, that's a $1 million question. I think anyone who that would be able to answer this, they would be, yeah, they would be a millionaire. No, but look, it's always about the needs, needs and user experience. You can create something from a new, have a new idea, and that's great. But I think you're pretty safe if you go with someone's need, whatever that need would be. If there's a need, there'll be a product corresponding to it. And then it's up to you how to make it sustainable. And user experience. What I feel that sometimes really in the sustainable business ideas, especially smaller ones and startups, what is lacking is the user experience. And another thing is that usually startups are really struggling to bring in marketing and marketing too late. So marketing is the people who actually help you to shape the product, examine the market, the price, the demand, and everything else. So the need and the user experience, and then from operational side, bring in marketing people.
All right, I'm going to slightly ask this question a little bit differently based on your response. From your point of view, are there specific needs that could be met on the waste side of things that you think someone could pop in?
There's so many needs.
Name a few that I don't know that are the most that you're the most passionate about.
Well, let me think. I mean, look, in theory, many of needs linked to the waste reduction or zero waste could be easily addressed, except one, and there's a high competition in that field. It is, substituting plastic. And I think many people are working on this now, on different solutions. And that will remain the highest challenge. How do we substitute plastic? I would need to think really to find. I mean, I would need to have a moment to think, to have maybe to have well, to respond to this more in depth. But I think, yeah, when it comes to waste, many of the solutions exist already. It's just that there's no financial incentives or there's not enough political push to put them in action, unfortunately.
Would you, we're kind of about to wrap up, but would you then, let's say, agree with this statement that with the waste problem, to some extent, a lot of the solutions we need are not necessarily tech solutions, but essentially people solutions or stuff that like behavioral solutions or something like that?
Financial solutions. I mean, I know it goes, it probably is even, you know, it's not exactly what you would like to hear, but it's just, but it's important also for the startups who are creating new products, what they need to understand, where we need to go in terms of legislation and in financial incentives is that something is a product that is highly polluting, creating a lot of waste, will be facing a lot of taxation. It needs to be taxed. I don't see how we can avoid this.
Yeah, I actually, one, oh, go ahead.
No, and so, and on the opposite will be the solutions that will be reuse, recycling, upcycling, you know, materials that are doing no harm. And then those will be sustainable, long-term, cheaper.
One thing that you mentioned this time, I'm kind of curious to get your take because I think this popped in the news recently. You were really harping on tax. And I saw recently a number of articles have come out that basically have said, to some effect, offsetting doesn't work. There's been kind of a recent thing. I'm really curious about your take on this. This might be the last thing we do.
Look, it's not about offsetting. It's actually, you know, let's say last week I met a lady in shop and she had forgotten her bag and she had like this little package that she could have easily put her in her handbag. And I told her, do you know, by the way, that all plastic bags of January next year will cost €1? And she said, oh my, really? Then I will start to need to carry the bag with me because that is really a bit too much. And that is the rationale that we need to have. We need to incentivize from all the sides and with taxation or other incentives, but mainly financial incentives, say, okay, this is pointless. This is pointless packaging. This can't be recycled. This is harmful, and just put unreasonably high price on it. So no one actually buys it and are actually going towards something else. The same is in the production. If you have these over packaging or packaging that cannot be recycled, that is too thick, tax it. Why there is still, it's 2022. People are doing crazy things where, you know, we have space rockets, we have domes under the earth. We're doing crazy things. Don't tell me you cannot have a technology for packaging that can be recycled. I don't buy it. I understand it's easier and cheaper for you to produce in this manner now, but it's not sustainable because I will put a tax on it on your way of packaging things, and then you will have the incentive to change. And I'm 100% certain there are technologies, there are solutions to avoid that kind of packaging. And when the colleagues will come up with, you know, products that will replace plastic, then it will be a different story. But currently, it's still unbelievable that we have packaging or materials that cannot be recycled and that they were overproducing, we're overusing without any kind of, so to say, financial punishment.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the ESI What's Next podcast. ESI is a program aimed at fostering socially responsible, environmentally sustainable student innovation through education and new venture creation. We're grateful to the European Regional Development Fund, Printify, SEB Bank, and Remy for their support. Tune in next week to find out what's next in the world of student entrepreneurship.